Morning, Bob, from the specific group in Las Vegas, Nevada.
My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And only through the grace of God, I've been sober since Halloween 1978. Delighted to do this. I am supposed to talk about one of the key ingredients to this, ultimately a surrender process that I've tried to engage in over the years, that eventually brings me to a place where I'm starting to live in the zip code of carrying out the decision in step three. When it came to step two, like everything in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had my difficulties with. AA is a funny place. It's one of the few places, if possibly only place on earth, where the things you get wrong are more useful than the things you get right. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about how I got some of this stuff wrong. One of the problems I've always had with AA is not really a problem with AA. It's a problem I bring to the table within me. And that is a misperception of things. And I'm a smart guy. And smart guys know things they don't really know. You know, I'm just that way. I'm a smart guy, right? And so smart guys look at stuff like AA and it's a religion. It's some kind of creepy New Age religion. And I was in a treatment center, and they made me go to these meetings. This was several years before I got sober. I remember sitting in a meeting. It was one of those kind of meetings, if you've ever been new with untreated alcoholism, where you're kind of, everything just annoys you. And happy people really annoy you, right? It's one of those kind of, and there's this guy, and he's sharing, and I swear to God, you could hear angel wings flapping in the background when he shared. One of those super spiritual meetings, if you're sitting there with untreated alcoholism, just creep you out. Just creep you out, right? And I'm incensed. I'm just angry. I don't want to, I feel like I'm being forced to this stuff. And I went to see the director of the treatment center, the place I'm living. And I told him, I said, you know, I know somewhere in the Constitution I have this right that you can't make me go to this. Actually, the Constitution says freedom of religion. It doesn't say freedom from it, but I interpret it as freedom from religion. And I said, you can't make me go to those meetings. I know it's a religion. He tried to tell me it's not a religion. It's a spiritual program, and I'm colorblind to that. I don't get the difference. And he says, it's not religion. And I'm thinking, listen, they spent the whole meeting talking about God. They passed the basket and prayed twice. I mean, if that's not a religion, I don't know what is, right? But he says to me, he says, well, listen, you don't have to go to those meetings, but if you don't go to those meetings, you can't stay here. And it's the dead of winter in Pennsylvania. And I have nowhere else to go. So I can be flexible at times. And I went to those meetings, but I showed them I didn't listen to one damn thing. And what I bring to the table is this closed-mindedness. And it's that if you were to sit me down and try to explain to me that I'm closed-minded, I'm not. I'm not closed-minded. I'm right. That's the problem. And one of the things that it talks about in our book that I have to lay aside is something I don't even know that I have. It's my prejudices. And if you follow the process, which is kind of a process, I guess, inadvertently to God, that's outlined in this book, it never looks like a process towards God. It's a process away from self. And when you move away from self, something funny happens. This power shows up. Because it can't get to me, because I got too much of me between me and God. In our book, it says something very interesting on the beginning of the chapter, We Agnostics, and it says if you have two things present, you're in a bad spot. The first thing is if you find when you honestly want to, you can't quit entirely. And I couldn't. For a short period of time, I could get off. I could stop drinking if you kept me medicated enough. But I couldn't quit entirely. And I always went back to drinking. Always. And the other thing is or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, and that was always true for me. It says if those two things, or either one of those two things, and I think it really takes both for me, but I think they were trying to not scare people off that couldn't, they were delusional about one of the two things, so they said or. But if you have those things in place, the book says, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And then it goes on to talk about exactly what my dilemma is every time I'm faced with this proposition. It says, to one who feels he is an atheist or an agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. And it really did. I remember sitting in a rehab the last couple years that I was in and out of AA and in and out of abstinence. And I was in an institution where they brought in it was up in Maine, and they brought in a group of trustees from the Alcoholics Anonymous group at Thomaston State Penitentiary in Maine. And they had this speaker who was on live. Now, by this time, I'd been to probably 100 meetings in various places. I've been to a lot of AA meetings. But they had a speaker at this meeting that they brought in from the prison who was unlike anybody I'd ever heard. He didn't look like anybody I've ever seen in AA. Nothing about him. He had long hair down to here and a beard and covered with tattoos. And he was an outlaw motorcycle guy, and he killed a cop. And he was one of those shotgun, carrying, like, wacky guys. The kind of guy that when you're secretly weak and scared and pathetic, you like to drink with. Because, they cover your back. I mean, those are cool people to drink with when you're secretly... You'd be three or four guys like that in a bar, and you could just talk all kinds of crap to a whole lot of people and then point at your friends. Right? I mean, that's a cool deal. And he was one of the few people in AA I've ever saw that in Alcoholics Anonymous. As I'm listening to him tell the story of the running with the gang and the shotgun killing the cop and all this stuff, I'm thinking, oh, man, I'd have drank with that guy. And I couldn't say that about a lot of people in AA. That to me, in my misperception, a lot of the people in AA looked like and sounded like maybe they had a martini too many at the golf course, said something embarrassing to their boss, and went to AA for better business connections, right? But this guy was the kind of guy, he was a drinker like I was. It's funny, I only listened to him. I probably heard 100 speakers that I could have identified with if I could have got past my judgment of them. I couldn't hear him, but I could hear this guy, and he's got me, man. I'm ready to now. I'm thinking I'm getting my mind's opening up. I'm thinking I'm going to sign up for AA, and then he talks about hitting a bottom in prison and going to an AA meeting, and then he starts to talk about finding God, and the minute he started talking about finding God, it was like this steel door started to close in my head, and I remember sitting there and almost in disgust. And a sadness about me looking at him and thinking, oh, what have they done to you? Oh, no, not you. You're a cool guy. Oh, you're a sunbeam for Jesus. Oh, no. What have they done? No, just, it's like, oh. And what's the problem? Him? No. The problem is that I brought a lot of fear-based prejudices to the table. And why do I have these things? Why am I so adamantly opposed to this? Why do I have to put down people who talk about God? Well, there's been a dynamic that's been in me as far as back as I can remember. I'm the kind of guy that if I walk into any situation and I'm afraid, and I get a fear that you won't like me, I don't like you first. Right? Have you ever seen the movie Pay It Forward? There's a scene in there where where Kevin Spacey and Helen Hunt are in this parking lot. They've been dancing around each other and not having a relationship, but kind of, you know, they both kind of want to, but they don't. And she finally gets tired of it. She corners him and says, "Listen, you're afraid I'm going to reject you." And then she says something I thought was brilliant. She says, "I can't. You're too quick for me." And that's the story of my life. If I was afraid you were going to reject me or not like me, or I'll beat you to it, man. I just have put a label on you, throw you aside. And I did that with God because I have this idea, this feeling that is down into the center of my being that I, if there is a God, I'm just not going to measure up. I can't believe that something so powerful and so good would possibly help something that's so weak and so bad. Because I always secretly knew what I was. And so I just throw the baby out with the bathwater, and I start the last period of my alcoholism that brought me to the suicide attempt and brought me to that place of that it talks about, and there is a solution, that place where it says we come to a place where we believe in the hopelessness and futility of our life as we've been living it. And therefore, when we are approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left but to pick up a simple kit of spiritual tools. Isn't it amazing that when I got to a place where I'm ready for you and ready to entertain God and open that door, it's not because I've moved closer to God. I've moved further away from me. Spiritual growth always seems to come from subtraction. It never comes from addition. That's why guys that go, I know a couple idiots that grow. They go off to India, you know, because they want to. They tell themselves the big lie. I want to grow closer to God and spiritual. No, what they want to do is they want to grow above everybody else. Right? That's what they're doing. And to grow closer to God is not to, it's really to grow closer to people. It's to grow away from me. Because I've always been the problem. In our book, it says something very interesting. It takes us through this little journey on the first page, actually in the preceding chapters, this little journey in opening my mind to, I get to a place and then it hits me with the actual dilemma. And it says, lack of power, that was my dilemma. It doesn't, and see, a lot of us get to that point through step one, and we think lack of religion is my dilemma. How many people we lose in Alcoholics Anonymous because it's like they get right up to the door. Right to the door. All they got to do is just a couple more steps, man. A couple more. Just a little further. And they're free. And they misinterpret what they're looking at. And then they turn and they go over here. How many, I can't tell you how many dozens of people we've lost like that. And it's not the fault if they go to church. It's just, the church is great. Church is wonderful. They were just, God had brought them through their pain and desperation and hopelessness right up to the door. They misinterpreted what they saw and they turned left. We see that all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it's not lack of religion. And oddly enough, it's not even lack of faith. I've sponsored a couple members of clergy over the years. Two of them, of the four that I've had the chance to work with briefly, or some of them for a couple long periods of time, two of them are sober. I was almost going to say and doing well, but that's a real matter of opinion. They're sober. And they're doing fairly well, I suppose. They're hard to sponsor. It's like sponsoring an alcoholism counselor. Or, you know, they're very difficult to sponsor. But two of them died of a disease. One of them literally drank himself to death. He called me a week before they found him, and he was drinking, and he was full. He was just like me too. He was full of all that self-pity. He was on a crying jag. You know, he's calling me and he's crying into the phone. And it's not even crying. It's something more heart-wrenching than that. It's like a wail. He's wailing into the phone in this hopeless despair because he can't understand why a man who's devoted his whole life to God and has begged God not to ever let him drink again, and he's drunk again, and there's drug dealers and pimps and prostitutes in AA that are staying happily sober forever. In his mind, it doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem right. He doesn't understand it because he has absolute faith, probably more faith than I have or ever have had, that God's the answer. Knows it. He knows it absolutely. But the problem isn't lack of faith. It's lack of power. I live in the desert in a place that in 2 months of the year it can get really hot. It can get at times like 120 degrees. You know, they tell the tourists, so don't worry, it's a dry heat. Let me tell you, so's hell. All right. it's hot. I mean, it's hot. It's really hot. And if I were to take you in my car and drive you a half hour, 40 minutes outside of Las Vegas, I'd take you to this lake, beautiful lake, huge lake, one of the largest bodies of fresh water in the western United States, Lake Mead. Take you out there, drive you up to the edge of the lake, let you get out, take a handful of that water, drink that water. Put you back in my car and you would have absolute faith that water's there. Now I'd drive you 20 miles away, let you off in the middle of the desert with a map and a set of explicit, specific directions how to get back to that lake. And do you know that you could wander around that desert and die of thirst, knowing and having absolute faith that that water's there? But if you don't follow the directions to get to the water, you will die of thirst knowing that it's there. And I think that was Frank's dilemma. Frank never doubted that God was there. He just couldn't access the grace. There was too much of him between him and God, and he didn't know it because his prejudices he believed were the right kind, and he didn't even know they were prejudices. That's just things that are the way they are. But in the book, oddly enough, it doesn't say that our prejudices are wrong. It doesn't even make a judgment on them. It just asks us to do something that he couldn't do, just to lay them aside. And often, if you have a strong religious background and you have a lot of that stuff within you, often you'll come back and you'll pick them up. And in the light of your new God consciousness through the steps, you'll go, that's right. That was right all along. But doesn't mean you don't have to lay it aside. Because it's baggage that interferes with this experiential thing you're trying to enter into to develop a real substance relationship with this power. To carry those old ideas, and whether they're right or wrong, into this trying to form this relationship with God would be like me trying to enter into a friendship with someone after listening to their ex-wife's discussion about that guy. You know what I mean, right? She could be right, she could be wrong, I don't know. But the problem is now in trying to form a friendship with this guy, every time he does something, I think, I wonder if that's what she meant. And it will block my ability to form an honest, real, interacting relationship with that guy. It will prejudice my perception of him. And unfortunately, that's what happens with some of this stuff. And the book's asking me to do something that is very difficult if you have the ego of a chronic alcoholic as I have. And my ego only cares about one thing. It wants to be right. It will... Do you ever know... Did you ever notice how when your ego gets, it makes a judgment about somebody, like a resentment, right? And you're judging someone to be just a self-centered idiot, a bossy, controlling, self-centered idiot. Did you ever notice that from the moment you make that judgment and develop that resentment, that's all you can see in that person? It's like it changes your perception and they can't do anything right from that moment on because the ego demands to be just, demands to be right, demands to be justified. And the my sponsor talks a lot about alcoholism being a disease of perception. The problem with when it's, if you have the ego that I have and the disease of perception at the same time, all of this goes on, and I don't know that it's going on. That's the problem. It's not what I know that's going to kill me in alcoholism. It's what I don't know. That's why alcoholism, one of the worst things that treatment centers ever did was to convince people this is a disease of denial. This is not denial. If it was denial, it'd be manageable. This is like beyond, this is why it's beyond human aid. We have to have divine intervention and a sponsor that keeps his foot up your butt half the time. Because as I'm walking towards the abyss through my judgments, ego, and perception, I don't think I'm doing that. I've been going to meetings twice a week, per average, in detoxes and institutions for over 29 and a half years. And I can't tell you how many hundreds and hundreds of people that I've met that were sober over 10 years and drank again. And you know, it's odd. If you ask these people 2 weeks before you picked up that drink, did you imagine that you would ever drink and end up here again? And to a man, they will answer unanimously, absolutely not. They never knew what was happening. Because when you think about it objectively, if they knew they were about to burn their life to the ground and lose everything they had, they'd go, whoa! But they don't know. They don't know. And that's the problem with alcoholism, is I don't know. That's why I imagine I will always need a sponsor and I will always need divine help. Lack of power is my dilemma, and these prejudices will cripple me in this process. So the book's asking me to lay them aside, to become childlike, to become the person the Buddhists talk about that's enlightened, the person that knows the most important thing you will ever know, and that's that you don't know. And if I can come to the table and try to form a relationship with something I may or may not even believe in, from that childlike position, something will happen. And that's 50% of the equation that the book talks about. The other 50%, the second thing it says I have to do, is I don't have to believe, but if I can express a willingness to believe. And one of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous that I think differentiates us from every other spiritual movement on the planet, every other self-help group, every other type of therapy, is that we are action-oriented. A lot of places will want you to believe, and then once you believe, then take the appropriate actions. In AA, we don't care if you believe or not. We want you to act as if you believe, which is hard on the alcoholic ego. Because the first time, if you're like me, first time somebody in AA ever told you, well, just act as if, you go, well, I'm not going to do that. That's phony. Right? You know, it's here's a guy laying in the gutter, dying of alcoholism. But what you're asking me is below my standards. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy. But I was lucky. I was so beaten up inside that I was willing to start following some directions. I was willing to take the actions. And there's a thing that exists called a working hypothesis. And I think that's really what this dynamic of take the action and then let's see what happens. And let's see from the results whether there's a God or not. Let's try a working hypothesis. So the people in Alcoholics Anonymous tell you, behind this curtain of life, there's a power. There's a link to that power somewhere in you. You don't believe it. Perfectly all right. We're going to act as if that's true. And let's see what happens. If I were to go down to, I don't know if you can do this anymore, but I remember years ago in National Geographic reading articles about these Aborigines that at that time had never experienced like electric lights or any kind of modern technology. And you could take one of those guys and you could bring him into a room like this with the lights off and show him the light switches and tell him that if he pushes those buttons, this room will light up like daylight, and he's not going to believe it. Matter of fact, he will be absolutely sure that that's impossible. But it doesn't matter, because if he pushes the buttons, the lights come on whether he believes it or not. And it is in the taking of the actions and the reaping of the results that he will come to believe that, my God, there was some sort of power in that wall that did this. And I think that's the exact same thing we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't believe in God, but the people in AA do. They tell me to take these actions. One of the things they told me to do was get on my knees, which I thought was beneath me. Get on my knees and start asking whatever was running the universe for help. And they told me it was perfectly all right that I didn't believe in God, just do it anyway. And I started doing it. I was living in this halfway house, and I'd go in the bathroom and lock the door. And I remember, so that's how much of a knucklehead I would take the throw rug, and I'd push it up under the crack in the door so no one could peek under there and see me pray. You know, I'm like nuts, right? I actually did that. It was so bizarre. And I'd get down on my knees, and I'd feel like a hypocrite. And I'd feel awkward and clumsy, and it was kind of embarrassing to me. But I'd get down on my knees, and I'd do it anyway. And from the moment I started the approach, from the moment I started acting as if maybe there was some sort of power here, things started happening in my life. And I'm, you know, I'm asleep at the wheel. I'm so wrapped up in me that it's hard for me to be in touch with reality. A thing that later in the book they call the great reality. And miracles are start happening in my life, and I don't really get it right away. I'm just thinking I've just gotten smarter or something. I don't know what I thought. But I don't get what's happening, the cause and effect, right off. But these coincidences started to pile up. And all of a sudden, I started realizing something's going on here. I've never been this lucky. I've never had... I'm a guy that if there's a bad deal out there, it's mine. Right? I'm the guy, if there's a bad decision to make, I'm making it. I'm the guy, if there's some bad luck, I got it. And all of a sudden, it's like I'm on the other side of the deal now. And all of a sudden, and the only thing that had changed was that I was acting as if there was a power source there that would help me. And what's starting to happen is I'm starting to get the help. The very fabric of the universe is starting to shift synchronistically towards the end of my wealth, my better welfare. And I had all kinds of weird things start happening to me. I'm living in this halfway house. My one roommate is dealing heroin, and the other one's smoking pot. And I got that lonely, depressed thing going on, and I want these guys' approval. And I'm in dangerous, dangerous territory. It's just a matter of time before I'll cave in, because I'm not a strong guy. Lack of power really is my dilemma. And what happened? And it happened only because I'm acting as if, and I'm trying to tap into a source of power I don't even believe in. Out of nowhere, a guy came to me, and he'd heard that one time I had credentials and worked as a counselor. And he offered me a job with room and board working in a treatment center for the treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction in teenagers. And I'll tell you something, that job was divinely crafted for me. It was perfect. I got to be helpful and useful. It did not pay very much money, which was perfect, because you'd given me a lot of money at that point, I'd have to go to a saloon and tell everybody how smart I was. It was just a little bit of money, enough to start chipping away at a couple of men's and put a dollar in the basket, keep myself in cigarettes, and get me to meetings. Just right. Free room and board. They encouraged me to go to meetings. I could go to 3 meetings a day. Take off, go to a meeting. It was fine. Perfect. One day, a little after I left that job, and I got a job as working as a cashier in a store. And it's one of those mornings where I went to work, and something from the previous day, my boss came and talked to me about, and he disrespected me. And I'm infuriated. I'm gonna quit the job for sure. And it's like iffy whether I'm gonna punch him or not before I quit the job. Well, at least I feel like that rage, like, because he's disrespected me, and I'm just a nutcase. And by noon, I'm so insane that I don't know what to do. I'm so enraged, so I don't go to lunch. I go get my car, get this little old beat up $100 car, and I shoot across town to a noon meeting that I normally don't go to. And I go in and I sit down in that meeting, and there's a guy, a stranger in the meeting, and he's sharing about an incident that happened to him at work, where he had done something out of line and his boss had to correct him, and how he just got enraged and went crazy and was going to quit his job, and his sponsor made him go back and make amends to his boss, and how much he loves working there. And I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, I'm going, whoa, that's exactly what has happened to me. And who choreographed that guy to go to that meeting that day and share that? Who put the desire, which comes from two Latin words, dire, D meaning of, and sire meaning father, who put the desire within me to go to that meeting? Who choreographed us dancing together? Who brought us together by divine appointment? And you have enough of those experiences occurring, and you start, it's freaky, you start realizing something's going on here. Something's going on here. And I came to believe, really, the only way that a guy like me possibly could, by the results of my what was happening in my life from the actions I was taking. I just came back from Europe, and I just heard something that was kind of sad. There's sections of London around the a palace and Buckingham Palace and Hyde Park, and still they have instead of the electric street lights, they have the old fashioned gas ones. But years ago, because of the change in technology, what they put in these computerized electric starters that turn them on at a certain, right at the right time, at when the sun's coming down, etc. But years ago, and I just heard that they're talking about replacing them with electric, taking the gas out of there. It's because it's getting too expensive, which I think made me feel kind of sad, because every time I go over there, I like the look of the gas deal. But years ago, before they had the technology in place, they had guys that their job was to go up and down the streets of London at twilight with a key, and you can still see the holes in the side where the keys used to be. Now they're closed up, and they'd open this little thing and they put the key and they'd turn the gas on. And then they'd reach up with a long pole with a flame on the end and they'd light the street light. And you could climb up to the top of the highest building in London at twilight, look out over the city, and no matter how hard you looked, you couldn't see where these guys were, but you could see where they'd been. And that was my experience. I could sit in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings at 2 or 3 years sober, and as it is today, often in my life, I couldn't see where God was, but I could always see where he'd been. I could see where he'd been, not only in the coincidences and the loving pushes and shoves in my life, and the people that were brought into it want just when I needed them. I was amazed at how God works. Sometimes it's the last moment. It's like it's like the Indians are circling the wagon train, and all of a sudden, just as they're getting ready to shoot the arrows, here come the cavalry. But I think God must have watched some of those old movies where at the end, it's always last-minute stuff or something, because sometimes it's at the very last moment. But the cavalry always comes. As a matter of fact, I've come to imagine that the moment from the moment of desire and need, the cavalry leaves the fort. Now I'm over here scared to death, and I don't know that they're on their way, but they're always on their way. They've always been on their way. I've been waiting for 29 and a half years for one instance where God would screw me up, because I'm going to tell everybody. And it's never happened. He's always been there for me. And I started to come to believe the only way I could. And this prejudice thing I often, with guys I sponsor that are new, I will ask them to, through contemplation and meditation, to try to get a sense of what their prejudices are. What are the things in me that make it emotionally impossible to trust God when the fear is on me? It's easy to trust God when things are going well. But what do you do? What are the things in me that make it difficult to trust God essentially at the times I need to trust Him the most? It's when the Indians are circling the wagon train. And I found over the years that we have some... Sometimes these prejudices are linked to things that happened in our childhood. Maybe someone you love very much was sick and you asked God, please don't let him die, and they died anyway. But often, whether you've had those instances or not, inside the heart of every alcoholic I've ever talked to is an unbelievable sense of unworthiness. Is a secret sense of not deserving or measuring up really and truly to this help. Last year, I went with my friend Scott L. from Nashville and a whole bunch of AAs over to Europe to did some stuff. And we had a day to go to Florence, and I was very excited about Florence because I'd been hearing from my friend Jim about this experience he had in Florence at a museum with a statue by Donatelli called the Magdalene. It's a statue of Mary Magdalene. And I was over there before and I couldn't find it. I hadn't done the homework to find out where it was. And this time I did the homework. I knew exactly where it was. So I get a little ADD sometimes, I guess. I think I had that before it came out. A little compulsive, obsessive. So I got this whole, I'm dragging this whole crowd of people through the city of Florence, and they're wanting to look at something. No, we'll look at that later. Come on. Because I want to see this statue, right? I don't know what it is about me. I get something in my crosshairs, I can't see nothing else. It's just... So I got all these guys, and we get to this museum. Once we get in the door of the museum, paid to get in, I've lost them because I'm like a crazy person. I'm shooting through this museum up and down the stairs from room to room because I want to find this statue. And I walk into this room, and on the wall there's this huge crucifix. And I look around and I turn, and standing right in front of the crucifix is the statue of Mary Magdalene. And I knew what it was the minute I saw it. And it felt like as I looked at it, I think for a minute I might have stopped breathing. It was unlike any depiction of Mary Magdalene you'll ever see. It's not Mary Magdalene that's pretty with the long flowing hairs and the robes. This is a Mary Magdalene covered with sores. Mary Magdalene with malnutrition. A Mary Magdalene dressed in rags looks like she hasn't eaten. It's awful. A Mary Magdalene with a look of hopelessness on her face, a, a look that, like, as if she'd been turning nickel and dime tricks in the back alleys of Jerusalem for years. Somebody had kicked her teeth out. And I looked at the statue, and there are these jagged, broken teeth. And this horrible, horrible, hopeless expression on her face. And yet, in the midst of that, she has her head cocked, and she's looking up at something, which I don't know what it is immediately. And she's got her hands like this, not in prayer. There's a hesitancy in her hands as if she's not worthy to even pray. And she's looking up, and I look across, and she's looking up at the crucifix with this expression on her face as if she was saying, this could be for me? For me? And I'm standing there looking. When I saw the broken teeth, I'm standing there and I'm weeping. I'm standing, and it's a public museum. I'm standing there and I'm crying. And then all of a sudden I look, and there's all these other AAs, and Scott Lee he's a weeper. I mean, he'll weep at McDonald's commercials, man. And, oh, he's just crying. All these other people are crying. And these Italians and other people are going through the museum looking, all these old weeping Americans looking at this. What are they weeping? They're looking at this ugly statue. What are these people? Must have made no sense to them. But see, when we looked at the statue, we saw ourselves. That's why we were weeping. We saw every bit of our struggle, every bit of our hesitancy, and every bit of our feelings of unworthiness to approach God. It's hard to save your own life when you secretly hate yourself. It's hard to accept help when you believe with everything in you that you don't deserve it. And so these are the great prejudices that I must lay aside. And those are the ones that seem to be the most deadly to guys like me. See, God has always, 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 always been there for me. He's always been crazy about me. There's, matter of fact, I am absolutely convinced there's nothing I know no matter how despicable, no matter how heinous, there's nothing I could do that would ever get God to stop loving me. The problem is when I do those things inside me, I must, because of my shame, turn away from the light. It is me that turns away from the light. The light never turns away from me. And that is the problem. That's why the cleaning house process of the steps is so essential. Not only essential and vital, there's absolutely no lasting connection with this power that can be made until you do that. And that's something that has been known inadvertently throughout history. William James knew that as he studied people, alcoholics who'd had conversion, born-again experiences, how often those experiences wear off. How often the shine of them dissipates and the old personality eventually reasserts itself. One time in a workshop, I just on a fluke, there's about 80 people or so in the room, and I just asked, I said, how many people here have ever been saved or went to get serious about church and had a born-again experience and then drank after that experience? And over a third of the room raised their hands. See, that's the problem. I put to the ego, no matter how demoralized I am, no matter how broken and beaten and how, no matter what happened, how hopeless I become, no matter how much I surrender, the ego grows back like a bad tumor. It always grows back. There is, and I don't know what it is about me. I'm an event-oriented guy. I want the prayer. I want the prayer that I say that surrenders me once and for all. But the problem with a chronic as opposed to an acute malady of my spirit is that there is no ultimate fix, just like there is no ultimate fix for any chronic illness. There's no ultimate fix for diabetes, for certain types of heart condition, for alcoholism. Because it is a permanent condition that can only be treated but never cured. The book says we're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. How do you maintain your spiritual condition? How do you grow spiritually? Through prayer and meditation? Well, yeah, but that's not really it. Bill says it the best in his story when he talks about us, and he says, unless the alcoholic can enlarge his spiritual life through two things, and it's not prayer and meditation. It's through self-sacrifice and constant work with others. And unless I can enlarge and perfect my spiritual life through those two things, he says, you'll never, ever, ever survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. Certain meaning they're coming. They're coming. You're doing really good. Everything. There's no problems on the horizon. You think you're out of the woods? No, sir. No, sir. I, in a sense, from starting to take these actions, unbeknownst to me, started building a spiritual weapon and a spiritual warfare that I don't even know I'm in. The ego always comes back. The ego always clamors for dominance. And the ego doesn't care if it kills me, as long as after I'm dead, everybody knows how right I was. That's all it cares about. As long as maybe you had this experience. This is the ego, the clamoring of the ego when you're drinking. Do you ever have those fantasies where you think of ways that you could die saving like orphans and stuff? Right? You know what I mean? Did you ever have those little thoughts? You know, those little. Like you could maybe save, throw yourself in front of a bullet of somebody, great, important person who's trying to be assassinated or something. Now you're dead, but after you're dead, everybody's going, oh my God, were we wrong about Bob? The ego never goes away. And it is the thing that blocks me. Page 55, and I'll talk about this real briefly, and we'll shut her down. Page 55 is really a vision of exactly what will happen to me and exactly what I'm going to find as a result of steps 4 through 9. As a result of cleaning and clearing out, uncovering, discovering, and discarding the stuff that has been blocking me from God. And it's 3 points that it says in the middle two paragraphs. It says that this power is deep down within me. Now, on first approach, if you're like me, that is a hard pill to swallow. That something so good and so powerful could be inside something so weak and pathetic and bad. But it says that it's there. And the reason I can't access it, because if you're new and you go to a meeting, you hear some old timer talking about communing with the God within, and then you go home and try to be quiet with just you and look for God. You're not going to find God. You're gonna go nuts. I mean, you're gonna be turning the TV on in about 30 seconds, because when it gets quiet out here, it gets crazy in here, because I am blocked. The book uses the word obscured. I am obscured from this power by 3 things, and they're all manifestations of self. By calamity, and we're great producers of that. By pomp, I get so full of myself and my judgments and my perception that there's no room for anything else, and for worship of other things. And the worship of other things thing is so subtle that it sneaks up on you. And sometimes the ego, they say, is edging God out. But I don't just edge God out. I always, as I'm edging Him out, I'm moving something in His place. Because there is no vacuum in this world. And so as I'm edging God out, and I don't know I'm edging God out, I'm moving a Harley Davidson right in here. I'm edging God out, don't know I'm edging God out, and I'm moving that relationship right in there. As I'm edging God out, and I don't know that I'm edging God out, I'm moving Him out, and I'm moving this resentment, this thing I'm right about that I have to make them see, right into the same place. Into the center of my consciousness. And years, probably about 1980, late 79, maybe a guy told me something. He said, when you worship other things, all it means is to obsessively turn your consciousness towards. You want to know if you're worshiping something? Make a pie graph of everything you've been thinking about, and the thing that owns the pie is obviously the thing you're obsessively turning your consciousness towards. And sometimes that's been a relationship. Sometimes it's been money. Sometimes it's been the job. Sometimes it's been something I'm right about. Sometimes it's been something I'm so afraid of I can't stop thinking about it. But I am the initiator of all of that. And for me to grow closer to God, I must continually, through the help of a sponsor, uncover, discover, and discard the flotsam and jetsam of my ego that always clogs the channel and blocks me. Thank you for listening.
Oh, okay. At this time, we'll take a 5-minute break, and we'll be back for question and answers. Here's Bob.
Sometimes they call this questions and answers. I think it might be questions and dumb looks. I'm Bob Stone, alcoholic. Make me uncomfortable. I don't care. Chris.
In regards to your relationship with your higher power and coming to believe and so forth, have you experienced times when you talked a lot about early sobriety and how you came to believe? Have you gone through periods later on, say at 10 or 15 or 20, 25, where you felt a total void and no connection to God, even though you're taking the action? And if you have, what did you do about it?
You know, I've had that a lot of times. I just came out of an experience like that, of a period of, I guess you could call it a period of spiritual desolation, where you go through the motions, but there's no conscious contact. There's no sense of a presence or anything. The first time I ever experienced, I had a spiritual awakening of sorts that I was suspect of for a long time when I was in detox the last time. And I, in a moment of weakness, I fell down on my knees and I begged something I didn't even believe in. And something kind of happened to me that I was suspect of. I thought it could have really just been an emotional release, or it could have been DTs, or I don't know what it was. But from that experience, something had changed in me, and it was really good for a while, and then it dissipated. And then I eventually had to go back and work the steps. And when I worked the steps, when I was 4 years sober, and even though it was my third inventory, it was the first time I followed the book, I got a tremendous connection with God. Spiritual growth often, as you clear away parts of yourself, it's almost like that creeper pot that they had. Do you remember creeper pot? Back in the 70s, it was this marijuana. You'd smoke it and you'd go, oh, this stuff's bum, it doesn't even work. And you just walk away, and 20 minutes later you're going, wow. It just kind of builds slowly. Well, a lot of AA's like that for me. I do these actions, this is bunk, it don't work. And then all of a sudden, wow. And the first time I lost the deal, and lost it suddenly, and sometimes you can lose it suddenly, and sometimes you lose it incrementally, was a very frightening thing. And I'm one of those guys that every time I enter a stage of desolation, once you've tasted the connection and you lose it, now the loneliness of the desolation is sharper by contrast than it was before you ever had it. One, Sam Shoemaker, in his poem, Stand by the Door, says something. He says that once you've tasted God, then from then on, nothing but God will ever do again. And It become the desolation is sharper by contrast. And I have a tendency to beat myself up when I'm like that. It's funny how prejudices that I go back to a default position of something's wrong with me. And here's what I've discovered over the years. And I've gone through, I'd imagine 10 places, 10 spots of desolation since I've been sober, probably. I would think 8 at least. I don't have a scoreboard to keep track, but I know of many times. And I've come to when it happens to me, I go back, I do some cleaning house to see if I block God. And sometimes it's subtle little resentments that I don't even realize are resentments. I just went through the steps again from beginning to end because I was blocked up by some resentments and some fears about a year and a half ago. And I went back through them and it got me back on track again. And then there are other times where I'll go back through them and it's nothing. And I believe that I am being diligent. I believe that I'm being fearless and thorough. I don't have any resistance, and yet there's nothing that seems to be blocking me. And I've come to believe that the soul, my spirit, has its seasons. That there's just something about me that cycles through periods like the seasons of the year where it's springtime and things are growing and it's just really cool, and then other times when everything is just healthy and then it starts to wither and withdraw, and it's normal. But my alcoholic ego will use absolutely anything to its own self-grandizement and sense of importance, and it will take times of disconnection and try to make a big deal out of it, because my ego will tell me that it is my divine right to be hooked up, plugged in, turned on, tuned in at all times. As if my ego expects that life itself should be like 5 shots of tequila when I was 15 years old all the time. And if it's not, it starts beating me up or starts beating you up or beating life up or beating God up. And somewhere along the line, I've just come to accept that that's part of the deal. There are times of desolation. There are times of connection. It doesn't mean that I'm doing something wrong. But you said the important thing. When I'm plugged into God, I don't change the game plan. When I'm not plugged into God, I don't change the game plan. My actions are the same in times of desolation and in times of connection. And what happens is, as my emotional or spiritual demeanor goes like this, my life goes like this. If you become self-centered enough that you can't focus on anything except how you feel, then as your emotions and spirit start going like this, your actions, self-centered people, self-obsessed people allow their actions to follow their feelings. And then what happens is you destroy yourself sober. You take the first 2 letters off the word spiritual and you have the word ritual. That this is a ritual. I tether myself to certain actions and people and ethics and principles regardless of how I feel. Because my feelings and my spirit just, what's the difference? Ask yourself, can you even remember that bad day you had 3 years ago? Right? My actions are what define the course of my life, nothing else. Did that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Barb?
Barb and Milton. How do you do step 2 with a sponsor?
I keep it real simple. There's this one paragraph. It just is the whole thing for me. The rest of it really is working the rest of the steps. And I think one of the confusing things for me is the word came to believe. As if, like, in order to have done step 2, I'd have to really believe something. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think if I can do these two things it talks about right here, it says, as soon as I was able to lay aside prejudice, and I asked the guys I sponsored, let's make a list. Let's put down, let's see, what are your ideas? What are your conceptions, your opinions, your sense, your perception of God that makes it hard for you to get in the wheelbarrow? Let's look at your prejudices, and then once we get them down, we got them out in the open in the light of day, let's consciously move them aside, which means I'm going to act as if they're not true for right now. But they may prove to be true and may prove not to be true, but for right now I'm going to lay them aside. And then the second thing, it says express even a willingness. I will get them taking actions, such as praying. I ask the guys I sponsor to physically get down on their knees when they pray. And I do that because I don't end up sponsoring very humble people. I mean, if you came in here really humble, you probably don't have to get down on your knees. But when you got a big ego, it's important to get down on your knees. Not because God needs you to get down on your knees. You need to get you down on your knees. To know exactly, help push your ego aside, to know where you stand in this relationship. And then I start trying to push them through the rest of the steps. And that's the great promise of Alcoholics Anonymous for all of us. Universally, all over the world, is that if you take these actions, something's going to wake up inside you. You're going to have an awakening. And I think really, realistically for me, in my experience, I didn't come to really believe until way down the road. I was past step three. I was somewhere in nine, I think, before I really came to believe. There's like a... Like sometimes in the realm of the spirit, there's a backwash. You're doing all you think you're on this step, but inside you, it's step way before that's coming. The wash is coming down. You know what I mean? I don't, that's my experience. Anybody else? Hey.
Hi, Bob. I'm Carl. I'm an alcoholic.
Carl.
I've had this thought. When you talked about acting as if, and you just talked about coming to belief down the line. In the back of my head, I'm going, I think step two is, shouldn't be step two, it should be down. The coming to believe should be further down in the steps. I'm not going to rewrite the book, but from my own experience, I didn't come to believe, I just did what I was told. I come to believe that if I do what I'm told, there might be some hope. But as far as, my perception of God and a higher power, did you ever have an experience with thinking that this step is not in the right spot?
In a sense, experientially, I know exactly what you're talking about. And, that was actually the experience of Frank Buckman. In the Oxford group, Frank Buckman believed that you couldn't possibly turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Don't even try until you cleaned house first. He believed it was a futile attempt because you're blocked. That you must rectify this state of separation. You must get you out of the way. You must dismantle, get rid of all your resentments and forgive all those people and make it right. You must abandon all your fears, clear up all your self-gratification stuff, get first before you could connect with God. And I think that experientially that's true because it doesn't promise in the book a nearness to our Creator after step two or after step three. It's not until after step five. It is only at that point, after I've cleared out some stuff that's been between me and God, that I really start to get, as you said, that's when it's almost like that's when you think this step two should be here. Because now I'm really starting to come to believe, as it says in this, the fifth step promises, I start to experience the new nearness in our Creator. What had once been a belief now becomes a spiritual experience. It's really after step two, after step five, that stuff starts happening in here. But that doesn't mean we can't act. But I think step two really is more of, are you willing to believe in your own hopelessness and act as if for right now? That's kind of what that's about. To me, in my experience. Yeah.
Can I follow?
I can.
Yeah. kind of hit it when you were sharing earlier, but I was just wondering if you could maybe repeat that or share some different conversations you've had with sponsees as far as help, advice or methods to get rid of your prejudices about your heart of power and believe that it can actually...
To help them to get rid of theirs?
Yeah.
There's an old adage that I don't know that I can. There's an old adage that those convinced against their will are of the same opinion still. I think the great persuader is alcoholism. If I'm trying to work with someone who is really full of prejudices, and they're right about those, and we enter into conversations about them, and they're very defensive about them, I have to surrender to that and give up. I was working, you know, the hardest, it's odd, when it comes to alcoholism, assets become liabilities, and liabilities become assets. Sometimes, in the real world, if you're really intelligent, and well-read and smart, that's an asset. When it comes to alcoholism, that's a terrible liability, man. I'm telling you. The smart guys raise their hand continually in meetings. I mean, they just, yeah, here I am again. And years ago, I was working with a smart guy, and he had a lot of prejudices, and he can't see that they're prejudices. He thinks he's right. He thinks my stuff is prejudices. And he corners me one day, and he says to me, he's a bright guy, well-educated beyond his capacity. He says to me, he says, are you open-minded? I said, well, I think so. I hope so. He said, let me ask you something. Are you willing to entertain the possibility that there really isn't a God? There never was. That your life and the great things that have happened in it are really you, and you've just convinced yourself it's God. It's a delusion, and you believe the delusion and act as if there was a God, but you really made all this stuff happen. Are you willing to entertain that possibility? And I said to him, I said, well, you know, I don't know. Maybe I am so delusional that at that time I was probably sober 17, 18 years, I don't know, well, pretty while, maybe all these years experience is a delusion. But I told him something that was my great reality. I said, you know something, even if you're right, even if I die and find out that there's nothing except an abyss after I die, that there never was a God, that it really was me that had transformed my life, I'll tell you something. I will hang on to that delusion rather than know the truth and go back to a place where I'm trying to get enough courage to kill myself one more time. I would rather have the delusion. And he looked at me like, how do you argue with that? That's the great power of Alcoholics Anonymous in this process, is not that I'm going to convince you of anything. I'm not. But I will share my experience with you. And if you connect with it, and it lines up with certain things in you to help you to open your mind or make a transition, then I've done my job. I've shared myself in the light of God's light with you. And if it doesn't, then I have to accept that reality, that that's not your deal right now. But you know, if you have alcoholism, you'll get sober. You will quit drinking and you will find God. Some of us get to do it breathing. But we all eventually stop drinking, one way or another. And you know something? It is only my prejudices that tell me that this way breathing is better. How do I know? Maybe in the big picture, it's all the same. Maybe in the big picture, there is no difference. How do I know? I am just very grateful that I am here. I'm breathing. I'm useful, and I found this life here. Anybody else?
I'm having alcohol
Hey, Henry.
You mentioned about this when you have a certain prejudice or set of perceptions, and then every person, you're interacting with the person, it's reconfirming on their own. I'm feeling I've got that going on a couple of ways, and I'm clearly aware of what my part in this strained relationship is. But it's pretty much a daily interactive, someone I have to interact with a lot. And any experience with kind of breaking through that, how I can really get out of that and come in service to someone like continuing to judge.
That has also been my great struggle in sobriety. And what I've discovered, you know, my ego is so cunning, baffling, and powerful. The Christians, I saw this on TV one time. I was watching one of those Sunday morning religious shows just briefly, and I heard this minister say something. He says the greatest trick the devil ever performed was to convince people he didn't exist. And I was sitting watching thinking, you should see the alcoholic ego. It puts the devil to shame. I mean, right. And my ego will stop at nothing. It will take passages out of the big book. It'll take the traditions. It'll take all kinds of spiritual principles and use them all to be right. And it in the book, it talks about an answer. And it's a two-part answer. It says to be free of these judgments, which it says resentments, to be free of these resentments, we can't wish them away any more than alcohol. What do? And then it says this was our course. And the first part, it says we had to realize how the person who'd harmed us was perhaps spiritually sick. Well, that's usually as far as I go. Yeah, they're sick. And boy, are they assholes. You know, right, you know that I get. My ego likes that part. Oh, yeah, they're sick. Right? My ego likes that. And that a lot of times that's as far. And when my ego is deluding me into thinking that I've actually spiritually processed the resentment, usually that's as far as I've gone. And then there's a next line. It's very subtle. And in the middle of the line was the key for me and is the key to this day. It says that even though we didn't like their symptoms, in other words, column two, the things that they did or are doing or continuing to doing, and how their symptoms of their ego, self, etc., disturb me, that I must realize that they are like me, perhaps spiritually sick. And now I'm supposed to look at this a different way. It says we're prepared to look at these things from an entirely different angle. And the key for me to get free of resentment comes through forgiveness, but I am incapable of forgiving someone till I get them. Till I really, really understand them. And to see myself in them unreservedly. And the ego, I'll tell you, if you're like me, my ego balks at that because to do that, it doesn't get to be right about them anymore. That's the problem. And what I've found absolutely every time when I can do that, when I can somehow push this ego aside that it has a strong entrenchment in this situation and actually other-center myself enough to really get how I could be that guy. If I was afraid a certain way, maybe if I was raised a little bit differently, or if I was frustrated or scared enough. Because, you know, if you inventory yourself over the years, you start getting it. You get, if you're scared enough, you can do some wacky, selfish things if you get me scared enough. And if that's true for me, wouldn't it be true for him or them or her? And so can I get it? Can I see myself in them? And then what happens to me universally when I do that is that I start to awaken to this is me. This is, not only is it me, it's an aspect of me that I have never been right with, that I have never mended, within me. And then the book follows that up with a synchronistic thing. And it's a combination of prayer and action. And prayer and action together. Prayer, I tell you, my experience, prayer of and by itself is great, but doesn't really change a lot. But when you mix prayer with joyous expectancy, with actions as if the prayers are going to be answered, that's when magical things start to happen. And with the prayer is that I ask God to help me to show them, which means demonstrate towards them, act towards them, to help me to show them the same patience, pity, and tolerance that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. This guy that's irritating me, what if I discovered that he had a brain tumor that was making his behavior that selfish and that erratic and that angry and that whatever his thing is that's disturbing me? And I really got it that could be me. If I had that brain tumor, I would be doing the same thing, and not because I'm a bad guy. And when I start to understand and then act towards the guy with God's help, I'm asking God to help me to do that. And I start treating this guy like a guy who's not an asshole, but a guy who's scared. A guy who's frustrated. A guy who's everything that I so easily could be if I was in his shoes. Then I am really healing not only the relationship between him and me, but I'm also healing something in myself that is of him, because I'm him also. Right? Do you know what I mean? I am him. And my ego tries to tell me I'm not. That's why all resentments have a sense of smug superiority about them. Right? It's the separation of when you tell yourself, what an asshole, I'd never do that. Well, the truth is, yes, I would. On the wrong day, on the wrong emotions, yes, I'm telling you, I could be that jerk. I'm capable of it. And the ego tries to tell me I'm not, but it's not true. It's not true. I just had a thing at the airport. Oh, my God, it was fun. It's embarrassing. But see, there's only one do not in the whole big book. Do not be discouraged. I get discouraged a lot. I'm sitting in the plane. There's a guy behind me drinking. One right after another. And every time he gets up to go to the bathroom, he grabs the back of my seat and it goes like this. After about the fourth time, I'm in my seat. I'm just making my seat go back and forth. And his wife's going, what's wrong with that guy's seat? It's going back and forth. Like, as I'm like thrashing out as a reaction to him, right? And then I sat there the rest of the plane and had 50 conversations in my head with him that I never actually had. Right? And why? Why did that happen? Because I was afraid. He didn't even know he was doing that. He's just getting up and he's a little overweight and he can't, you know. And that's what I had to get free of it. I had to put myself in his shoes and really get that it wouldn't because I'm trying to make the guy upset. It's because I wouldn't even know I'm doing it. He's trying to steady himself. And when he grabs the back of my seat, it may irritate me, but he doesn't get that. Right? But after I tried to rock back and forth severely like a little kid having a temper tantrum, you know, he never did that again. And there was also a cold front that went up between that row and my row. And you know the sad part about that? I thought about this later. He's an alcoholic, I suspect. That could have been an opening or a door to a conversation that could have been useful, and I'm having a temper tantrum. You know, that's the sadness of ego, is it blocks me if I get these missed opportunities. I could have maybe just entered into a conversation with this guy and gotten around to, you know, he might have maybe offered to buy me a drink, and I could have said, oh, you know, thank you. At least I loved to drink, but I had to. It was killing me, and I could start telling him a little bit about my story. Maybe it would have been an opening. And I missed it. I missed it because I'm too full of myself. That's just yesterday. So if you think, if you if you think I've gotten better, don't delude yourself. I hope I don't.